Ladies and gentlemen, once again, welcome to the Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. I'm your host, Brian J. Rowan, and joining me, as they do every week, Danny King, writer for the Film Stage.
Hello, welcome.
And Nick Newman, associate editor for the Film Stage.
Hello, welcome.
You two did like the same thing last week where you just copied each other. This is getting bad. Hopefully, when we get into our discussions, we will not have the same problem. Speaking of which, this is how we operate here. We will have a brief movie-related discussion on topic either in news or just in our own personal worlds of film, and then we'll launch into a feature review, which this week will be Arbitrage, the new film starring Richard Gere. Then we're going to give you our look forward to the week ahead, giving you our best bets for DVDs, movies, and random recommendations of things that we watched on our own. So let's get right into it. Today, our movie discussion is going to center around the idea of video on demand. For anyone who doesn't know what video on demand is, you obviously haven't been watching enough television because it's on literally every commercial for any cable or satellite provider. Video on demand is the means by which a new film that is either about to hit theaters or is already in theaters is simultaneously available on iTunes or in the video on demand stores, Comcast, Verizon, they all have them. And we wanted to talk about this insofar as how it affects the world of movies as a whole. Do we use it? Do we like it? Do we think it's a good business practice? Really just anything about it, because during the course of this podcast that we've done, we've watched quite a few movies on demand. And we thought it would be a good idea to get into that, especially since Arbitrage came out both in theaters in limited release and on demand in VOD. So, Nick, why don't you kick us off here? What are your thoughts on demand?
I have not used on demand that much in my life. I can think of, I don't know, it's less than 10 instances where it's actually been implemented by myself, and one of them was for today. So maybe that should say something. My experience with it has been mixed. I find that there is, of course, a convenience. You don't have to go out to the movies, and it often costs less money than a regular movie ticket. But there are technical difficulties with the process. Often they need to fashion this thing a little more clearly, I think. And I'm speaking as someone who's used it both through a cable box and on the internet. It's not entirely ideal in that sense, but I do like it. I think it's a smart system. Perhaps it does signal the phasing out of the theatrical experience, which is unfortunate, but I think that the films that you typically see on demand are not ones that necessarily demand a big screen. I mean, Mr. King and I saw The Master in 70mm last night, and that's not a movie I'd want to see on my computer for the first time.
No.
Exactly. The Master you don't want to see on VOD. So it's also about the films that you're seeing, too. So it's all right. Get the technical aspects a little more clear, and I think there's a much brighter future in it.
Excellent. I agree with you definitely that there are certain movies that you wouldn't want to watch on demand. Luckily, everything that I've watched for this podcast through this means of consumption has actually been pretty good. And I definitely think that there's a certain type of movie that benefits from this. Because as movies have gotten prohibitively more expensive and gas has gotten more expensive and the costs of going out to a theater have gotten more expensive, people are kind of saving themselves for the big event pictures. And so smaller films like the ones that we've watched, and I'm going to run them down really quick. Some of you may have seen these in theaters, but Take This Waltz I watched on demand, Sleepless Night I remember we did on demand. Clown was a video screener through the computer, but I'll still count that because I think that also came out on demand. And God Bless America. So, I've already got my tickets bought for the 70mm projection of The Master going on this Friday at AFI Silver. Thank you, God. Finally. And obviously, I wouldn't watch The Dark Knight Rises in a video on demand. But I definitely think that movies like these that are smaller and that are interesting and definitely worth seeing but may not draw people out of their houses towards the cinema definitely benefit from this kind of release. I've got a personal story related to our movie today that will give me my reasons that this is still something that needs to be worked out to reach its kind of zenith of quality. But before we get into that, Danny, why don't you give us your quick thoughts on Video On Demand?
Well, I think you guys kind of hit the major points, which is that, you know, you kind of have to gauge which films would benefit from the VOD system and which ones wouldn't, and also which ones you would want to, which ones you'd be fine watching on your computer or your TV, and which ones you'd want to see in the theater. One of the things that just kind of gets me thinking, and it's probably because VOD is still kind of a blossoming technique, there's no real like rules to it, but when I think of a movie like Arbitrage, which we'll be reviewing today, that seems to me like a movie that will appeal to mass audiences, and like it definitely has a Sundance background, but to me it's a very mainstream movie with movie stars, and so it's kind of strange that that would be a movie to use the VOD kind of panel. And I think also last year with Margin Call, which used the VOD technique to great success, even getting an Oscar nomination for a first-time screenwriter, that seems to me like a movie that normally would be a pretty safe bet to just release into independent theaters right away. So that's kind of an interesting thing that I'm still tracking in my mind with regards to this technique.
Yeah, it's funny that you say the types of movies that seem like they should not be in video on demand, citing things like big movie stars and awards attention. I mean, this is a vaguely new process by which we can watch films. Is that a kind of stigma that has held it back in any way? Because, you know, before this, our basic closest analog was straight to TV or straight to DVD / video movies. You know, whenever anything skipped to the theater, the assumption was it's kind of crap. And obviously that's not the case, because we've enjoyed a number of the films that we've watched in video on demand. So is that not only holding back more people from using it, but also holding back more distributors from putting out films in that way, do we think?
No, I don't. I wouldn't say so. I don't think there's much evidence to support that notion.
I mean, I definitely don't think there's a stigma for home viewers, because if they're just at home wanting to watch a movie, you know, they'll kind of put on anything. I don't think they'll see like a Margin Call movie and be like, oh, if this movie had big stars and is playing on my TV right away, it'll be bad. I think they'd be content to give it a chance. I think that one of the articles we read for this kind of discussion was that Kevin Spacey had a bit of a kind of hesitation to agree to that, but I'm sure that was because it was like his first exposure to it. You know, a couple of years or a year or so past that, I doubt there's kind of a hesitation with actors.
I just wanted to ask because, like I said, you know, this is a vaguely new thing, and without the prestige of going into a theater, it just seems like that might be something that people would take into consideration. Obviously, I don't think that, though I still prefer the theater experience. So I like the fact that something like Arbitrage, you know, if I'd really had the time, I could have gone and seen it in a theater, which would have been great. But instead, I was able to watch it at home, which is also great, because I can't tell you how many films I've missed in limited releases because I couldn't find the time to go see them.
They're not near you.
Exactly. Well, luckily, I live in D.C. We get everything at some point. And that's the other thing. This allows for a much larger dissemination of these films, which is great, because these are oftentimes films that deserve to be seen, and I would like to make money. I was just about to do another plug for Paranorman and Lawless. But go out and see them. They need money. This is an industry that runs on money, so it's great that these films can get that kind of release, and people who, you know, like films like this and don't want to have to wait for DVD or Netflix are able to take advantage of that. Unfortunately, there are issues. I had to spend probably a good hour trying to see the end of Arbitrage. We're not going to get into spoilers now, obviously, but I don't know what the problem was. Obviously, I'm doing this remotely. I'm tapping into some kind of data stream network hard drive somewhere, and somehow the last 5 minutes just didn't seem important to them. And so the movie continuously froze. You can only fast forward at one kind of speed. There's no chapter selection like there would be on a DVD. And there's also no friendly theater patron coming up to tell me that they're going to give me free popcorn. I mean, I mean, I've had problems in theaters too. Prometheus and the Avengers, you know, the digital projection started stuttering and would freeze. And so, this is a tying into just the plain old move to digital anyway. So obviously, I'm still going to the theater for most of my viewing. Once these issues are ironed out, I think that especially for, like I said, movies like this, movies in limited release that take a little more effort to get to, it will be much more practical and appealing for me to do that. Unfortunately, things like what happened today hold my enthusiasm slightly at bay. I suppose it's the same reason I didn't buy the first iPhone, because I wanted them to make three more just to iron all the problems out.
And now you have to buy the iPhone 5, so you have a screen that's half an inch bigger.
Yeah, I'm okay.
Yeah, come on.
Do I really have to?
You got to be up with it.
All right. Well, Nick says I have to buy an iPhone 5, so I'll do that, because I have no will of my own. I had something else to say. Now I absolutely cannot remember what it was.
VOD.
VOD. Danny, your go-to response is just to scream whatever the theme or topic we're talking about is.
Usually it works.
It sometimes does. I've said basically all that I feel comfortable saying. You know, I'm not in it enough to really have a strong grasp on the business behind it. Like I said, I think that it's going to work well. And I remember back when Bubble came out, and that was the first film that got a day and date release where the DVD came out while the film was in theaters, and Soderbergh made a big deal about that. And it seemed like that was the future. And now it seems as though we might be at that future now, where these things can be streamed immediately. Can you ever conceive of a specific type of movie or a specific thing where you'd say it's in the theater, it's on TV, and you would just straight up go for the TV one over the theater one for any reason? Because I still feel myself getting pulled more towards the theater if I can work it out.
Like, Well, it depends, because I could have seen this in a theater today, but I saved time and money, so...
Yeah, and that's what I was talking about earlier. You know, there's a balancing act. And for the
master...
But
it's also because of the film that this is. This isn't something I feel like I need to see on a big screen or anything.
Precisely. And I think that's what it comes down to. And I was thinking about that as I was watching this movie, and this will help us segue into our review. I was looking at it, and I was like, you know, you don't see movies so much like this in theaters anymore. And when they do come out, it's kind of like a really small release, and then there's all the statistics about it underperforming or something. This is a kind of movie, and I say this in a good way, that I associate like with the 90s, you know, the paranoid political financial lawyer thrillers that came out then. And I'm pretty sure Richard Gere was in a bunch of those too. I was just kind of happy to see that again, and I was glad that I was able to. And no, not only that it was getting a theatrical release, but that it was in a way that other people who maybe don't like to go to the theaters or don't feel like that's the type of movie they need to see in the theaters can still get out there and see it right away. So that's my final thoughts. Anyone else got a final log to throw on this fire before we put it out?
No, put out the fire.
Put out the fire. All right. So we're going to douse our topic discussion.
We should say that whenever we end a section now. Put out the fire.
Put out the fire. Let's see if we can do that. That could be a catchphrase. Put it on a t-shirt. Look pretty awesome. Anyway, moving on into our primary review today. If you haven't figured it out yet, we're going to be talking about Arbitrage, which is directed by Nicholas Jarecki. Hopefully I pronounced that right. Also written by that selfsame man. Starring Richard Gere, co-starring Tim Roth, Susan Sarandon, Britt Marling, and a bunch of other character actors that are going to make you say, hey, I remember that guy.
A dedicated businessman, a family man, a man I am very lucky to call my mentor and my father.
World events all revolve around five things. M-O-N-E-Y.
Why sell our company? We make a great return.
How much money do we need? Do you want to be the richest guy in the cemetery?
Come away with me.
And so, Arbitrage. This is the story of a businessman. I believe he's a hedge fund manager, who is the perfect example of trying to keep too many plates spinning. He's got a little bit of a financial situation that he's fudged in his books that he's trying to see through during a merger or a buyout by another company at the same time that he's managing an affair, which leads to a lot of trouble. And just the way that he tries to make it through like the next 3 days without letting this elaborate lie that is his life fall to pieces around him. Would you say that's an accurate description?
Yes.
Fantastic.
That sounds just about right.
Great. So yeah, let's get into our feelings about this film. Danny, let's start with you since Nick started us off on the discussion topic.
Well, I think you got off to a pretty good start there by describing how deep of a knot this character is. And to me, that's kind of the main pleasure of the movie, is just watching Richard Gere watching him manage all of these problems while maintaining the kind of public facade of a very in-control Wall Street tycoon. And he's very well cast because, you know, he's notoriously handsome, although that's not really like something I would, you know, fawn over.
But it's okay.
It works for the character because the way he projects himself, he's able to still imply that deep down he's kind of panicking endlessly, and it works really well. In terms of the writing and the directing, I think it's a well-written movie. I'm not sure. The direction seems like it's always just in service of the script, which is well-written and kind of sharp and timely. The performances from kind of top to bottom, in addition to Gere, are really good. I like Tim Roth, especially, as this kind of sneering detective. His first scene with Gere is probably one of my favorites of the film. And also Britt Marling, who was really good earlier this year in Sound of My Voice. Her role here is almost, her presence is felt almost more off-screen than at her actual screen time, but she still makes a good impact. So overall, I would recommend it. It's a quality thriller.
Bringing up Britt Marling, I mean, obviously when I was giving the rundown of this, these are his personal and professional problems that are kind of coming to the fore, and she is the perfect encapsulation of the intersection between those two, because not only is she the chief investment officer, but she's also his daughter. And so her acting, as well as the writing surrounding her and her character in that situation, is a really integral part of this film, and I think it was carried off very well. Nick, what were your thoughts on Arbitrage?
It's about half of a good movie. I think the murder mystery, or not mystery, because there's not really a murder and it's not really a mystery, but the investigative aspect of the movie is quite good. Standard, you know, not reinventing the wheel, not even really shaping the wheel in a different way, but good, engaging and well-written and all that. But then there's also this aspect of the movie which focuses on insider trading. The parallels to Bernie Madoff could almost not be more clear. And those scenes are just deadly dull. I'm sorry, but I could barely hold my interest during those moments. I thought they were so stock and so overly familiar. And the film really suffers as a result of it. Every time it went back to a scene with Britt Marling, I just wanted to fast forward. But obviously I didn't, even though I could have. But I didn't because I'm a responsible critic. So it's okay, you know. I'm definitely glad I didn't go to the theater to see it. Glad I watched it on VOD.
Thank you, VOD. No, I mean, I can kind of see what you're talking about, because to me, the personal aspects of the story, and just because Tim Roth was involved, the kind of crime angle was more interesting to me. I mean, I understand that it's balancing one woman against the kind of financial decisions that have crippled a nation. But yeah, numbers don't interest me that much. So those things still never kind of snag with me. But I think that the way that the things that happen there are interweaved, and that they all collide in this character played by Richard Gere. And I guess we should say his name is Robert Miller. This character is the type of person who's responsible for these things, and juxtaposing the way that he treats business and the way that he treats his personal life really gives you like a sense of why he's doing these things and how he's gotten himself into this insane situation that he's incapable of getting out of, because he's the very definition of stop digging. He makes a hole and he's in it and he can still see the sunlight, but then he realizes that he's dug a hole and he's like, well, now I have to get out of this. And all he can think to do is dig down, and not only that, but ask other people to start helping him to dig. And they all do, because that's just the type of person he is. He's rich, he's powerful. As Danny said, he's like incredibly handsome. And he just wields that charisma and that power so effortlessly that you know, you can kind of see where the other people are coming from, and you know who these people are, these like sycophants who know what's happened and still do nothing about it. And that's even more terrifying in this movie. And this is, there are aspects of this movie that are kind of scary. Seeing what people are willing to ignore as a means of getting what they want. The character of Jimmy Grant, who unwittingly sort of aids Gere's character in this deception, is probably the best illustration of that. And we can get into that more in spoilers. But I mean, he is just like Britt Marling, like the linchpin of this film. Because those are the two characters who are not beyond redemption at this point. And watching them kind of struggle with coming to realize who this man is and what kind of world he lives in. That was powerful stuff to me. Is it great? No. Is it solid? Yes. Is it entertaining? Yes. And to me that was great. And I don't think I would have been disappointed seeing this in a theater as Nick was. But I'm still kind of glad I was able to do it sprawled out on my couch. Didn't fast forward or pause at any point. It still screwed up on me anyway. So that's annoying. But I'm not going to let that affect my opinion of the film itself, because I'm pretty sure the director didn't say, hey, with 5 minutes left in the film, let's make it stop playing. Any final spoiler-free thoughts before we dip into the more in-depth spoilery discussion?
What's going on with Tim Roth in this movie?
Tim Roth is being awesome. That's what's going on with him.
What's going on with his accent? This is the first person I've ever heard of who's from both New York and Boston.
It's amazing to question it.
It actually kind of reminded me of Guy Pearce in Lawless, only it wasn't
I know what you mean. It wasn't.
It didn't feel
same.
Intentional. And in my head, I kept thinking, do you ever see what a NASDAQ stock does to a mortal? And I love Tim Roth, don't get me wrong, and it's funny because he's good in the movie, but his, just have him be British, because nobody's really gonna go, well, why is he British, and then it's gonna ruin the experience for them. And if it does, they're stupid and they, you know, shouldn't, well,
there's
shouldn't worry about them
for that too, because the cop in Bridesmaids was from Ireland, so I mean, we're apparently comfortable with that now,
right? But what's going on here? Why is he, he's, you know, everybody knows Tim Roth by this point. You can have him talk one certain way and it'll be okay. It really bothered the hell out of me.
He has pulled off an American accent in other movies.
Yeah, like Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah. I mean, that's the go-to. It didn't bother me. I kind of liked it because everyone else is themselves, if you know what I mean. Like, there's never a point where Richard Gere really disappears into this character. And there's like a point where I found myself thinking, yeah, this is totally how Richard Gere is. Just because he's just that noticeable, memorable guy. You know, George Clooney kind of fell into that rut for a while too. And I don't know. So I kind of appreciated what Tim Roth was doing. I also loved that he, like Danny was mentioning, the scene where he and Gere talk for the first time. And Gere is, you know, composed as best as he can be. And he's in his fashionable expensive suit and making sure his tie is sitting correctly and trying to use good posture, and Roth is just like sprawled into the corner of a chair and he's like so flippant. It's great. I love that scene. I love Tim Roth.
His line reading of hate when that happens, that was like one of my favorite lines.
Yeah, it's great because you know, most of the times in movies like this, the cops for some reason just don't see what's right in front of him. And through this entire conversation, Tim Roth isn't even trying to hide the fact that he knows this guy's lying out of his ass.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked that. But also, he didn't press him on things that he didn't have. We can get into it more in spoilers, but I mean, his character is another one of these not quite beyond redemption people who has to grapple with a choice. And there's a lot of ambiguity in this movie because everyone's trying to screw over someone else to get what they want. And in fact, for anyone who's wondering, arbitrage is a financial term, which means the simultaneous purchase and sale of the same securities, commodities, or foreign exchange in different markets to profit from unequal prices, which basically means you value something different from someone else and is different from a third party, buy it from one person cheap, sell it to the other person high, basically in the same instance in order to make the most money for yourself, because whatever it was means nothing to you. Obviously, that can be used for the financial situation that Gere is in, but obviously it's also very relevant to the moral situation and who is willing to sell what and what pieces of their soul to get what they want. So perhaps a little on the nose, but hey, it's fine because everyone loves learning a new word.
So yeah, ahead. I don't know if it's on the nose because who really knows that word?
Well, that's the thing. It's like if you invent a word in a movie and you don't say what it is until the end because you're just like, I don't know. It's technically on the nose, but it's not like if I named a movie like "This Bad Guy Sucks" and everyone's like, "Oh, I guess that guy sucks."
Yeah,
I'm totally gonna do that now though, when I'm rich and famous.
Deceit.
Yeah, any movie that's like called like Deception.
There was a movie called Deception.
Compliance. Yeah. Dang. We should just have one discussion topic where we just talk about really on the nose movie titles.
Mm.
That would be awesome. I feel like Hunger would be in there, but it would still be okay.
Or Shame.
Yeah. Totally off topic. Let's get back on it. So, yeah, are we comfortable moving into spoilers now?
Let's do it.
Spoilers.
Yeah, let's go.
Danny, you were pretty, when I was trying to tell all of you what was happening with my viewing experience, you were pretty vocal about your love of the end of this movie. So why don't you fill us in a little bit on what it was and why you loved it so much?
I just think it's kind of a cool ending. I mean, like the whole movie, it's kind of slick and surface level stuff, but it's just well done and crafty and kind of clever. But yeah, that's really the only reason why I liked it. It's not really like a deep ending. It just kind of ends, basically. It just cuts to black. But in terms of more substantial parts of the movie that I really liked, you kind of touched on Nate Parker's performance as Jimmy Grant. What's interesting about his subplot is there are a lot of scenes where it's just him and Tim Roth, and you'd kind of expect the movie to drop off a little just because Gear's off screen. But the scenes between Tim Roth and Nate Parker are kind of some of the best in the movie. There's one where they're talking in the cab and, you know, Tim Ross is trying to convince him to give up Gear and the kid doesn't really want to do that. And it's just really good tension. And then there's a good interrogation scene. So, yeah, that was another part of the movie that I really liked.
I think that speaks to what I was saying about how the investigation aspect is by far the most interesting part, where even if Richard Gere is not on screen, you're still into it. And yeah, Nate Parker is very good in the movie. I have seen him in like 2-3 films, but I never really recognize him every time out, which I feel like speaks a lot to his capabilities as an actor. But I, at the same time, you know, I say this is half a good movie, because then you have someone like Britt Marling, who I've never seen before. This is the first time I've seen her in something. But I really didn't like her in this film. I thought she was sort of spaced out and distant, and felt like she was reading lines. She didn't feel like a natural actress to me. And I don't know if anyone else has an agreement or disagreement on that.
I've seen her not in Sound of My Voice, but in Another Earth, and she was really good in that. I think the problem in this movie is her... This might sound like I'm capitulating something. I mean, her character is sort of a symbol, like a token to be moved, and depending upon where she lands is how other characters win or lose. And she doesn't have many personal scenes. Like, they keep mentioning that she has a husband, but you don't get, like, those warm family moments where she's with him. And, like, there's a token scene like that at the beginning of the movie. But her work as the chief investment officer gets the bulk of it. And so it's really hard, like I said, when a movie gets too heavy into dialogue relating to finances or business, my mind has a tendency to disengage emotionally. So I know what you mean when you say it sounded like she was just reading lines, because how difficult is it to hold up a spreadsheet and like say that the numbers on it are wrong and make that something that someone really cares about?
I suppose that has something to do with the writing, but even in the scenes where it's supposed to be an emotional moment, an emotional epiphany, it didn't work for me. I didn't feel like she was actually Richard Gere's daughter who felt betrayed. It was just felt false.
Yeah, I do like the scene where it's her and Susan Sarandon as the mom, where they're kind of working out in the morning, and then they kind of have, I think their kind of emotional heart to heart works better than the one where Marling and Gere are just kind of bickering at each other for a few minutes.
Is that one in the park?
Yeah, the one in the park. I thought that was that scene is like obviously necessary to the narrative, but it is just kind of them yelling at each other. I thought the one with Sarandon worked a little bit better.
Yeah, the Sarandon scene definitely did work better because, unfortunately, again, the park scene is just that scene in a movie where you finally figure out what the hell's going on and, like, everyone has to say exactly what they're feeling and exactly what happened.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed that just because you see this person who seems so in control, you want to know how he lost control. And so it was just nice to get that fill in. But at the same time, it's one of those things where it's like, they even kind of, in a certain way, express to you visually that they know this is going to be a scene that's less interesting than the other ones. Because instead of having the conversation in an office or a car, like every other conversation in the movie, they go to a park. And so it's like, look, we know, we're sorry here. It's really pretty outside. Let's film this here. But yeah, I mean, I didn't have a problem with her performance. Like I said, I actually really liked it. And I thought the character was necessary and important to the narrative and had a good arc to it. But I can definitely see what you're talking about because I feel as though there's something innate in her character as a person and as an actress that maybe isn't quite as warm and lived in as other people.
It's true. There isn't enough innate Parker.
I wanted to talk about...
That was good.
I thought we'd gotten all the really shitty jokes out of our system. Obviously, I was wrong. Nate Parker, like, fantastic. Fantastic. And the other great thing is that this movie does have many subtexts that, you know, sometimes stray into text. And one of them is the fact that, like, there's all these rich, powerful white people, and then there's just the one black guy. And just kind of them preying on that difference, and not only society, but, like, socioeconomic everything. It just gives you this even greater idea for how friggin' predatory Richard Gere is, just in establishing his dominance in the world at large, I suppose. Because that was my first thought, like... The way this plays out is, you know, Gere gets into the car crash that kills Julie, the art curator that he's messing around with, and he goes and calls someone, and then I'm like, oh, I wonder who's going to pick him up. Like, maybe it's like, you know, his father's war veteran friend who's like a fixer. You know, if anyone watches Breaking Bad, there's a character named Mike who's like an ex-cop, private detective, all around, like, I will fix your problems type of guy. And I was picturing that. And then all of a sudden, a young black man has picked him up. And I was just like, oh, shit. I was like, they went there. But then they actually talked about it and brought that to the fore. And so I was a little happy. Because for a second, I was like, my white guilt was doing somersaults.
Yeah, just to say one more thing about the Wall Street jargon. Because I do kind of agree with both of you that it's like the least interesting part of the movie. There's a scene late where he finally sells his company. And that was like the one Wall Street scene where I actually knew what was happening. Like, I could tell what they were talking about. They were negotiating the price. And I felt like it was a signal to me that Jarecki didn't really know how to balance the jargon, was that he kind of said the same joke in that scene like three or four times, which is where they're talking about, like, oh, I would have gone lower, I would have gone higher. And the first time we're like, oh, okay, I actually got one of these scenes and it's funny. And then, like, the Mayfield guy is like, oh, yeah, I would have gone that far. And then Gere comes back and he's like, oh, yeah, I would have gone even lower. And then he walks out. It was the one scene that made sense, but then they kind of used the same joke over and over again. And that kind of bugged me a little bit.
Yeah, I kind of enjoyed that just because it was...
I mean, it was a fun scene. It just, like, the way it was handled, it just kind of seemed to me that, like, there was never really a true grip on how much, like, jargon they wanted to use throughout the film, or how much time they wanted to dedicate to those scenes.
Yeah, definitely. But I mean, I enjoyed those jokes just because it was kind of like, again, playing into that theme, like, there's a certain pride in how well I was able to lie to you. I convinced you that I was only willing to settle for this when really I would have done this. And it's just kind of, that's a weird thing to find pride in. I can't imagine normal human society lasting that long if that was really how we measured ourselves, like the metric of our character, which again is one of the things that makes this an interesting and compelling narrative that I greatly enjoyed. I too liked the end when I finally was able to see slash understand it. I don't know, there's something about that idea of just, it cutting out. And I mean, the impulse would seem to be that everything needs to be wrapped up completely, and a few of them are, but I mean, it's just nice to, it was a natural ending point.
Yeah. And I think it's pretty much wrapped up too.
Yeah.
Right.
But I mean, it's hard to explain, and I can't think of a specific instance in movies lately that I'd feel comfortable saying this about, but you know, there's always like that final ironic speech or something that has to happen where people will like really and I'm glad that was excised.
Right. I guess just narratively it's pretty clear what's happening.
Yeah. I'm just glad that it didn't feel the need to put this guy up there and have him make some either ironic or like revelatory moment speech. I enjoyed that. worth fighting with my VOD cable box for an hour to get to. But yeah, I haven't talked much about Susan Sarandon, so why don't we throw her a brief mention. What did you think of her performance / character in this? Because honestly, if there's one aspect that's insanely underserved, I think it's her relationship with Gear. They get like that final bedroom scene where she's kind of throwing an ultimatum at him, and I don't feel as though the tumultuousness of their relationship was set up enough to really make that feel like a big payoff as it wanted to be.
No, it feels like almost every scene that she's in is takes place in their bedroom. She's just kind of standing around or going to sleep.
I just got to stand here until someone comes and talks to me.
Yeah. Very, very weak stuff.
Yeah.
Not her performance. And the performance itself is fine, I guess.
Scene to scene, it was good. But like I said, because it was so thin and scattershot, it was kind of hard to see the arc between her pretending to be happy or being happy, and then at the end being like, I'm at the end of my rope, I can't handle it. And he brings up her drinking, and I was just like, I've seen her like have two drinks during this
movie. Yeah, that was weird.
I was like, you've had so many more drinks than she has. So I just, you know, I was looking at the cast list and I was like, oh right, Susan Sarandon's in this. I feel as though they could have done a better job of fleshing that out. But yeah, it might have ruined the pace a little bit.
Yeah. Did anybody else have the name Ted Kennedy pop into their head the second the car crash happened?
Yep.
Was that just me? Yeah. Chappaquiddick, yeah. All that fun stuff.
Yeah. And I mean, the byline, not byline, the subtitle, that's not even the right one. The slogan / blurb for this movie, I think, is power is the best alibi. And it's just that idea of, like, this guy is really important, so how intensely can he fuck up and still get away with it? And Tim Roth, his character's got a lot of, you know, kind of a class warrior thing to him, because he's constantly saying, like, why do these guys get to get away with it just because they're on MSNBC?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's definitely... I mean, basically, it's like Ted Kennedy and Bernie Madoff together.
Mm, that's a great combination.
Yeah, it's a terrible, awful pairing. But it makes for a compelling film. So I say definitely see it. I saw it on VOD and was fine with it. So you should do that. If it's in a theater near you, you should see that too. Because, I don't know, I thought the movie was well directed. And there were some things that I wondered if they would have been nice to see on the big screen.
Yeah.
I don't know. Price is comparable. It's like nine something to get the VOD. And that's about what a matinee here is. So...
It was only 7 on iTunes. So.
Well, son of a bitch. I wanted to watch it on a TV. Like, I didn't want to watch it on my computer screen.
I feel bad because I just decided to rent the standard definition version, even though it's the same price, because it's too much storage space. I thought it would take a long time to download. It turns out it does not. But watching it in standard definition, it felt visually very underwhelming. Like, the cinematography looked like a TV show from 2003. I don't know if that was just because of the way I watched it or if that's how it is.
I thought it was... I mean, it's definitely not a massive stylistic achievement. You know, they didn't get the cinematographer from the Tree of Life to do this. But I thought it was a pretty visually engaging, pleasing movie. Danny, what did you think?
I was probably in between, I guess. I just thought it kind of just served the story and didn't do anything that kind of stood out. The stylistic element that I liked the most was Cliff Martinez's score, which isn't... I mean, I'm not sure if it was used that often, but when it was used, I liked it.
Oh, he did the score?
Yeah, he did.
Oh, yeah, I didn't like the score of this film at all. So,
Jeez.
I'm very mixed on Cliff Martinez, I guess, because I like his work for, you know, Solaris and Contagion. So basically when he works with Steven Soderbergh. But
I was about to say.
His drive score, I think, is deadly dull, as is the
really
the arbitrage one. Oh, the drive score. Oh, God. It's the same tones over and over and over. It's bad. It's a bad score.
I'll have to watch Drive again.
You don't notice it when you watch the movie. Like, that's the thing. If you listen to it on its own, I remember when I bought the soundtrack, I was listening to it, and I went, what the hell is this? It's just ethereal sounds for 35 minutes.
I now have the song Real Human Being by College stuck in my head.
Well, the movie came out this weekend last year, so it's kind of fitting.
That was a good movie. I believe you now, though, when I'm at a party later tonight and I'm just going to be like slowly singing to myself Real Human Being over and over again. It's all
good,
you.
Good song.
It is a good song. It's a great song.
Are you going to stare longingly at a woman and Under Your Spell will be playing?
Yes. Yeah. If God is kind, that will be exactly what my night is.
Yes.
Instead of having to listen to like Call Me Maybe for the 20th fucking time.
Going to the parties.
I've got to. Anyway, this is getting personal and completely off topic. So final thoughts on Arbitrage before we kick off into our look forward to the week ahead?
Watch it on TNT.
They know drama.
They do.
All right. Well, then let's go ahead and start looking at some of the things that are coming out in DVD. On DVD. In DVD? It's technically in there. Anyway, it doesn't matter. We've got The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel, which I did not see. We've got Cabin in the Woods, which, hey, that was the first thing we ever talked about.
Hey, sentimentality, nostalgia.
Way back when. We also have Katy Perry's Part of Me, which is a thing that happened. And then we have Hysteria, The Salt of Life, Chico and Rita, The Woman in the Fifth, The Magic of Belle Isle, Detachment, Salvation Boulevard, The Baby Makers, and then I think we start to move into some of the TV selections. So, yeah, I'm just going to come out and say it. I've only seen one of these films, but it probably is the best anyway. So you should all check out Cabin in the Woods if you didn't do that first, the first time we talked about it.
Box office numbers indicate you probably didn't.
You sons of bitches.
I know. See that.
23 weeks ago.
Wow. Time goes by so quick. I might enjoy Best Exotic Marigold Hotel, honestly, which I feel funny saying because it looks so middle of the road. But I bet it's an enjoyable, you know, whatever.
Old people learning to live again.
Yes, and there's also, surprisingly, I didn't mention Dudeca Pentathlon is coming out.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
I don't see it on this. I'm going to have to start looking at a new DVD place.
And also Indiana Jones, The Complete Adventures.
That includes the fourth one, though.
I like the fourth one.
Oh, what is wrong? What? No, you don't.
It's
You're just
it's
trying
fun.
To be controversial, and I do not want that on this program.
But it's no more ridiculous than the second or third films. It's good. Orson Welles' Macbeth, which I've never seen in a proper presentation. I've only seen a crappy VHS of it. I might buy that because I'm a huge Welles fan, but I only feel like I've half seen that. And The Game is coming out on Criterion.
Oh, yes.
Which I already bought, actually. I don't like that movie, but I'm going to give it another shot.
I enjoy it. I'm surprised it's getting the Criterion look, but I guess it's like well-established auteurs, early film type of thing.
Yeah.
I was equally surprised that Shallow Grave got a Criterion release. And I like Shallow Grave, but who knows. Danny, what about yourself? What would you tell people they should check out?
I've actually seen quite a few of the DVDs. Detachment is Tony Kaye's film. His first narrative since American History X, I think. It's got a really good Adrian Brody performance, and the filmmaking in it is actually really exciting and kind of daring. The story gets really, really dark, almost like overwhelmingly so, but it's still worth seeing.
Really, the director of American History X?
Oh my gosh, it is dark.
And wasn't his other film a documentary called like Lake of Fire?
Yeah, I've never seen that. I think it was like an abortion
documentary. Yeah, it was about the abortion debate.
Oh yeah, they show an abortion in that movie.
Jesus.
Do they?
That's actually the one reason I've never seen it, because I know that, and I'm just like, I can't do that.
Yeah, that's fucked up.
Otherwise, I mean, trust me, I would see it. That's literally the one thing that's holding me back from it. But
wow.
Jesus. Let's move on.
Ooh.
Let's get this back on track. September 21st, coming out in theaters, we have Dread 3D, which is the remake, or, I don't know, reboot of Judge Dredd. So that's the thing that you can do to yourself. We also have End of Watch, which stars Jake Gyllenhaal and Michael Pena, and Anna Kendrick. We also have House at the End of the Street, which can be abbreviated to HATES, which seems like really poor marketing. That stores...
Yeah, they really set themselves up for that one.
Right? And they plug it. Like, have you noticed this now? When you see a TV trailer for a movie, or like a commercial, like, because it's different ratios, the black bars at the top and bottom will have, like, the name of the movie and the date it comes out prominently displayed throughout the entire thing. Right.
Worst.
The other thing they're starting to do now is put Twitter hashtags in there. So it's like, hey, if you want to talk about this, here it is. And this one is HATES. And I'm just like, I don't know, man. Maybe you should have picked something else. But Jennifer Lawrence, who's been pretty solid in everything I've ever seen her in. Elizabeth Shue. We also have Trouble with the Curve. Clint Eastwood, not directing, but starring. Amy Adams is also in that, along with John Goodman and Justin Timberlake. Perks of Being a Wallflower, which is based off the popular MTV novel. Directed by the actual author, I believe. Starring Logan Lerman, Emma Watson, Ezra Miller, and Paul Rudd. And then the documentary How to Survive a Plague about AIDS activists. And, yeah, that's about it. Unconditional, which I've never heard of. A woman's idyllic life is shattered when her husband is killed in a senseless act of violence. She prepares to take matters into her own hands. Two unexpected encounters begin to change everything. Yep, never heard of that. But yeah, so what's coming out this week that you think we should check out, guys?
I'm looking forward to Trouble with the Curve. I gotta say, I love Eastwood, and I think that the basic skeleton of the film from what we've seen looks pleasing, not monumental, but I think it'll be nice. I could make a joke about his speech at the RNC, but it's too easy, so that'll stay out of the way. But yeah,
insert your own here.
Exactly.
Yeah, I don't know. I like Jennifer Lawrence. Honestly, I'd go see anything with her in it, but I just can't bring myself to go see House at the End of the Street. I am slightly intrigued by End of Watch. I don't know why. Maybe I just have been feeling the lack of a really good cop movie lately.
Do you like the line in the trailer where Jake Gyllenhaal asks a thug why he's called Big Evil? And the guy says, because my evil's big.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
I'm just like, I mean, that makes sense.
It's so logical.
It's like statically logical. It's like you're trying to like start a conversation with someone that you see, and you're like, hey man, where'd you get those shoes? He's just like, shoe store. It's like, where do you go from there?
I just can't wait to see how Gyllenhaal responds.
It's funny that you mentioned that, though, because the first time I saw that trailer, I had to rewind because I thought that he said something clever and I just missed it.
Right. I think I did the same thing. Yeah.
And it's like, nope. He just says that his evil's big. Okay.
Best supporting actor.
Oh, God. I hope so. I don't know. Is it like a found footage or like mockumentary thing? Like, does it have
from what I understand, it's half and half. Like, half of it is from the police cameras inside the police cars and other weird things. And then it is not. I guess.
Yeah, because they show...
Which to me is a huge turnoff, because I don't like found footage. But if you're going to do it, stick to it. Don't go halfsies on me.
Don't go halfsies.
Unless it's like, you know, redacted by Brian De Palma, where it's...
Well, that's
sort
just
of
it's Brian De Palma.
A big... What's that?
That's just because it's Brian De Palma.
Well, no, but that's a good example of how you can do it, because there's a thematic through line there. This doesn't appear to be that. It's just... I just don't want to see this movie.
Listeners will be happy to learn that I was trying to come up with a portmanteau of De Palma and Apologist, and I gave up before actually coming up with one and springing it on you. So you were spared from that.
Apologist?
Yeah. Oh, damn it. You did it anyway.
It's kind of obvious.
It is obvious, but I didn't want to say it because we've already made so many crappy jokes. But yeah, Nick, you're a Apologist.
I don't apologize for liking him.
You're a Apologist.
No, I will not apologize.
But you're making apologies for him.
No, I'm not.
What?
No, it works in Redacted.
Okay, well, you liked Mission to Mars.
It's a good movie.
Anyway, moving on. Danny, what do you think we should see in theaters this week?
Oh, I mean, I think I'm seeing Trouble with the Curve on Tuesday, so I'll probably review that for the site. I've read the Perks of Being a Wallflower novel, and it was good. I didn't like fall in love with it, but that movie got really good reviews out of Toronto. So
yeah, I didn't like the book that much.
I mean, it was okay. I just thought it was kind of like a checklist of high school experiences.
Precisely. I felt manipulated by it. I didn't like it. But yeah, I did see the notices it was getting out of Toronto. So
yeah, I mean, I'm sure it's like a good cast. That's probably why. But it's interesting that the author's directing it. So
yeah, that gives aspiring authors hope for the future. I speak mainly of myself. I was going to say something. Oh, I mean, if you're wondering what we're going to watch to talk about on the next podcast, you should be happy to hear that we're going to talk about The Master.
That's right.
Which we'll be expanding this week. So really, given the quality of everything else we talked about, I'd say check out The Master if it expands near you.
Yeah, I don't think that's really a question.
Yeah, no question at all. But yeah, so let's buzz through our random recommendations, and then we can let these fine people go on with the rest of their day. So Nick, what did you watch this week that you think people should check out?
Well, I did see The Master, but I shouldn't really recommend that, because we'll review it next week. I did see Looper, but I shouldn't recommend that, because we'll review it in 2 weeks.
Why don't you pick something that you watched on DVD or something?
Okay, I'll go with a film titled I Can't Sleep, directed by Claire Denis, who I once recommended a film by, and Danny also recommended as well. So the pressure's on you, Brian, to watch one of her films, but I don't know if you'll do that. will you?
I'll try, yeah.
Okay,
where'd you watch it? Is it on DVD or?
Yeah, I got it from Netflix. It's her third film, only it's chronologically, it's the second that's available, because the second film just, you can't get it, I don't know. Anyway, this is quite an interesting film, because it's ostensibly about somebody who's a serial killer of elderly women, but the movie is only maybe 20% about that, and the rest of it is a look at what it means to be a modern person living in France, only in Paris, only at this time it was 1994, so it's not really modern anymore. But anyhow, it's quite good. Maybe a little messy for my taste, but I sort of liked the way it used mess. That was impressive. So I'll throw that out. Yeah.
All right. And Danny, what about yourself?
Well, I'm going to bend the rules here a little bit and recommend a 28-minute film called La Jetée, which was directed by Chris Marker, who just died this summer, actually. And this movie, in addition to being the inspiration for 12 Monkeys, it popped up at number 50, I believe, on the Sight and Sound list. And, you know, given that it's only 30 minutes, that really says something. And it is an amazing movie. It's comprised of still photographs, yet still manages to tell a time travel story, which is very fascinating. And it's just a narrative that gives you goosebumps. It's just so good.
Yeah, that's
really, it's on YouTube, yeah, if you haven't seen it.
Yeah, it's a really good film. And because it's on YouTube, I've actually seen it like 7 times.
Nice.
Did you count it as a film, though, if it's 28 minutes?
It was on Sight and Sound's list, man.
Bow to Sight and Sound.
All right.
It's a short film. Yeah. This is like my problem with the difference between novel and novella. I just don't know. I don't know what the difference is.
Length.
Length? I know it. Thank you, Nick. But is there like a number? It's not a page number because that changed on font. I don't know if there's a word number.
I would say over 150.
Over 150,000 words?
150 pages, but...
But that's the thing. Like, if you took Harry... Like, I don't know. It, depending on the font size and everything, like, that changes.
Sure.
You know, like...
I mean, it's just based on length. Do you not, like, get that?
I don't understand where the hard line is. Anyway, I'm going to find you and I'm going to kill you.
Novellas are shorter.
Shorter than what?
Apocalypse
Say novels,
now.
I dare you. Yeah, my movie recommendation this week. I have a lot of options. This is the first time I've had like options instead of just having to say like, well, I've only seen one film. It could be Shame, but I feel like I've already done that one. It, could be a lot of other things, too. But I'm going to talk about X-Men First Class, because every time I see that movie, I like it more. I don't know why. I don't dislike a single actor in it. It's actually got some of my favorite working actors in it. Great direction by Matthew Vaughn, who did Kick-Ass and Layer Cake and Stardust. And Yeah, I don't know. It's a great period piece, rollicking action. Special effects are dodgy in like three scenes, but whatever, I can get behind that. And the score is fantastic. Speaking of good scores. So yeah, X-Men First Class. Check it out. It's still a pretty heavy rotation on like HBO and things like that, so it shouldn't be too hard to find.
Yeah, I am looking forward to the sequel because I had fun with that movie, and I feel like, but also because I feel like there's stuff to improve on too, which I think they'll be able to when they're not so rushed as they were with the first time around.
Yeah, that was a rushed production, and they still kind of nailed it. That was still,
yeah, it's good. I mean, I think it's kind of uneven. What's with the guy who turns into a hard surface, for example? What is that?
Darwin?
Yeah, it's
his thing was adaptation, so he changed into whatever he needed to do to survive. Like, he also shoved his head in a fish tank and got gills.
Oh. There you go, Nick.
You know what? Okay, at least that makes sense as a genetic mutation. I want to know what genes you need to manipulate to be able to create a fucking tornado in your hand.
Whatever.
Right? I mean, it's the X-Men. Let's not look too deep into the science there. And I actually really like Darwin's character. We can't really talk about this. Spoilers. See X-Men First Class. It's a good time. So, yeah, that's about it. Like I said, next week we'll be talking about The Master, which we all will have seen in 70mm. So freaking excited about that.
Well, one person has to see it in 70mm.
Awkward.
What?
I said one person has to see it in 70mm, and that's you, because you haven't seen it yet.
I haven't seen it yet, no. But I'm saying that when I do see it, we all will have seen it. I already have my tickets, man.
Yeah, all right.
Yeah, but it's still, like, not the same, you know?
It's still not, because you're seeing it, like, so much later than the rest of us.
I'm just kidding. I'm going off Nick's mojo.
Nick is slowly infecting all of us with cynicism. God damn it, Newman. Anyway, next week's podcast on The Master by Paul Thomas Anderson. So look forward to that, because the word on that has been fan-freaking-tastic. So I'm sure we'll get a great discussion out of it. Until then, however you can find us scattered all over the internets, Danny, why don't you start us off? Where can we find you?
TheFilmStage.com, TheKingBulletin.com, and Twitter.com/TheKingBulletin.
And Nick?
TheFilmStage.com and Twitter.com/Nick_Newman.
And you can find me at TheFilmStage.com, as well as my own personal blog, DearFilm.net, and Twitter.com/BrianJRowan. I'm not going to spell it for you all this time. You should have it figured out. So thanks for joining us. Join us next week, and have a great week. And he just wields that charisma and that power so effortlessly. Wow, put like 6 extra syllables in that one. So effortlessly.
Third time's a charm.
Third time's a charm. Sweet. We've got the 5-year engagement. Nope. That was last week. That was actually 2 weeks ago. Jesus, I'm so out of it.